Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be reached at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the year-end double issue, dated December 31st, 2020, January 8th, 2021. So we'll get two readings out of this one. It's titled, as usual, The Faces of 2020. And oh, what a year it's been. As is typical with these faces of covers, it's very busy. A lot of characters in there. And let me see if I can give you a description. The scene is sort of a small town America, Main Street. The folks are out on the asphalt. The facade has, you know, older. There's stores boarded up and store closing. In the center of the picture is a presidential podium. Smiling Joe Biden is stepping up on the podium. And Donald Trump's trying to hang on to the podium, but Kamala Harris is off to the left. Trying to drag him away. Behind them is Amy Coney Barrett, the new Supreme Court justice, giving a big thumbs down look. And over their shoulders to the back is Black Lives Matter protesters with a George Floyd sign. In the background, Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump are walking along with suitcases, just kind of waving. Foreground has Rudy Giuliani. He's a looks like he's burning ballots in a barrel fire. Xi Jinping is holding a mask. Behind them, Dr. Anthony Fauci is smiling, and he's got a bunch of vials of coronavirus vaccine. Behind them, I think it's the Michigan governor, Gretchen Whitmer, facing off with some no-mask protesters. And behind it all, behind the facade, I just noticed is Elon Musk up in a SpaceX rocket. So a lot going on in 2020, as we said, quite a year. We'll go right into the main stories and see what we've got. We got three short main stories today. The first is Trump throws COVID relief funding into chaos. What happened? Congress passed a $900 billion stimulus package this week, ending a seventh-month impasse over coronavirus relief. But the bill hit a surprise roadblock when President Trump called it a disgrace and demanded more direct relief to American households. The stimulus bill, which was hammered out over weeks and passed resoundingly in both chambers, calls for a round of $600 payments to middle- and low-income Americans and their dependent children, provides 11 weeks of $300 unemployment benefits, and revives the Paycheck Protection Business Loan Program. It includes $25 billion in rental assistance, $13 billion to expand food stamp benefits, and $15 billion for cultural institutions, and extends an eviction moratorium. But Trump, whose Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin helped shape the bill without Trump's involvement, stunned Capitol Hill and his own aides by releasing a video in which he called the $600 payments ridiculously low and demanded they be increased to $2,000, suggesting he wouldn't sign the bill otherwise. The stimulus measures were yoked to a $1.4 trillion appropriations bill funding federal agencies through next September. Democrats jumped at Trump's demand for bigger payments. "Let's do it," House Speaker Nancy Pelosi tweeted, but any plan to incorporate them would face some Republican opposition, and a government shutdown looms on December 29th. It was unclear how far Trump would take his crusade. "He might forget about this whole episode," said a Democratic aide, Or maybe he'll just blow the thing up. Perfect coda to his time in office. Also this week, Trump made good on a threat to veto the $741 billion defense spending bill, but Congress was expected to override him. What the editorial said. Even $600 payments are too much, said the Wall Street Journal. Much of the money will go to employed middle-class Americans who will stash it away, boosting a personal savings rate that's doubled this year while generating little or no economic impact. The unemployment benefits are another blunder and will slow recovery by giving Americans less incentive to work at a time when many businesses are desperate to hire. Some 85% of the population will be eligible for at least a portion of the $600 payments, said the Los Angeles Times, including individual earners with adjusted incomes up to $87,000 and couples up to $174,000. But the broader economy doesn't need stimulus at this point, and this money should have been focused on people in crisis, the unemployed, renters, and food stamp recipients. And unfortunately, Republicans blocked aid to strapped state and local governments who may face extensive layoffs in 2021 unless Congress comes back with another rescue bill. What the columnist said. The need for immediate aid is dire, said Rachel Siegel and Heather Long in the Washington Post. Retail sales are lagging. Hiring has slowed markedly. Household spending has dipped. Thousands of businesses have closed. And up to 14 million Americans are about to lose unemployment checks. This bill promised a lifeline for households and businesses fighting to make it through the winter. Now Trump has left the entire bill's future uncertain. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is a no-win situation, said Sinead Baker in BusinessInsider.com. He can cave and accept a larger stimulus figure he fought for months, or he can block the bigger payouts and take the political heat for it. Trump just handed Democrats a big weapon in the battle to win the Georgia Senate runoff, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. The standoff makes clear Senate Republicans are the only real obstacle to more generous economic assistance, and that points to the real consequences of giving the GOP continued Senate control. Very little chance of another ambitious aid package. Once again, Trump is causing chaos with his last-minute intervention, said Robert Verbruggen in NationalReview.com, and it's unclear where it will end up. Maybe he's bluffing and will sign the bill. Maybe Congress will cave and add $370 billion to fund the $2,000 payments. Trump could execute a pocket veto by not signing it and forcing the next Congress to start over from scratch. A government shutdown in the mix here, too, with funding set to run out on December 29th. I guess it wouldn't be the Trump presidency if this went any other way. Vaccine distribution off to a slow start. What happened? U.S. authorities plan to distribute 7.9 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines across the country this week, a massive logistical effort that has been hampered by delays and fierce disputes over which Americans should be inoculated first. 14 governors complained that expected shipments of Pfizer's vaccine to their states had been cut by up to 50%, even as the drug maker reported it had millions more doses sitting in our warehouse awaiting shipping instructions. Army General Gustav Perna, head of the federal vaccine distribution, conceded he'd failed to anticipate rollout delays, but said the U.S. could still hit its target of delivering enough doses to vaccinate 20 million people by year's end. After winning FDA approval for its two-dose vaccine last week, Moderna said it is on track to produce 20 million shots, enough for 10 million people, by December 31st. To boost confidence in the vaccine campaign, Vice President Mike Pence, President-elect Joe Biden, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and other top officials received their shots in public. At Stanford Medical Center in California, more than 100 doctors protested the hospital's decision to vaccinate administrators and surgeons ahead of frontline healthcare workers, chanting, "Healthcare heroes, back of the line." Stanford blamed a very complex algorithm for its flawed plan. The U.S. is now averaging 215,000 new COVID cases a day and 18,000 fatalities a week, with total deaths above 325,000. A new, more contagious strain of the virus has been detected in Britain, leading New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to call for a UK travel ban. What the columnist said. Week one of vaccine rollout was a nightmare, said Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal in the New York Times. The ultra-cold freezers needed to store Pfizer's vaccine are thin on the ground, so healthcare workers in Georgia, for example, had to travel 40 minutes to get a shot. The Trump administration's failure to tell Pfizer where to ship doses caused widespread shortages. And this chaos will likely intensify as states try to solve other problems, like which essential workers to vaccinate first and how to notify people when it's their turn for a shot. It's likely most Americans won't start getting shots until the summer, said Ronald Bailey in Reason.com. But changing Pfizer's and Moderna's vaccines from two-shot to one-shot regimens could double the number of Americans who could be vaccinated soon. Trial data suggests Pfizer's vaccine is 82% effective after the first shot and 95% after the second, while Moderna's is 92% effective after one and 95% after two. Even if immunity waned away after, say, a year, a single-dose strategy would keep millions safe until vaccine production could be ramped up and booster shots administered. A word of advice if you're planning an indoor holiday gathering with friends and family, said Zeynep Tufekci in TheAtlantic.com. Don't. Hospitals nationwide are already overwhelmed. A post-holiday COVID surge could further cripple ICUs. Meanwhile, testing and treatment are improving and vaccines are arriving. If your loved ones can stay healthy a few months longer, they're much likelier to survive the disease or to avoid contracting it entirely. And that third main story, Russian hack poses biggest espionage threat in decades. What happened? The Department of Homeland Security's cybersecurity arm warned last week that an apparent Russian hack of federal networks represented a grave risk to the federal government, even as President Trump downplayed its severity and suggested China was to blame. The deepest known penetration of U.S. systems, the hack, which relied on malware placed in network tools, targeted nuclear laboratories, the Pentagon, the Treasury Department, and other government agencies. Microsoft identified 40 targets, including think tanks and sellers of security software that had unfettered access to their clients' networks. SolarWinds, the company that created the software taken over by the hackers, said its analysis revealed penetrations going back to October 2019. While the known damage centers on a compromised SolarWinds update, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency said that the hackers almost certainly used additional tools. Representative Jason Crow, Democrat from Colorado, called the hack the cyber equivalent of Pearl Harbor, while Senator Mitt Romney, the Republican from Utah, compared it to Russian bombers flying undetected over the entire country. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the breach was pretty clearly the work of Russia, and Attorney General William Barr publicly agreed. Trump, however, questioned the evidence of Russian involvement, insisting the espionage had been blown out of proportion and that, quote, everything is under control. President-elect Joe Biden said that he would impose substantial cost on whomever was responsible and accused Trump of an irrational downplaying of the attack's severity. What the columnist said. The hack is unlike anything we have ever seen before, said Josephine Wolf in Slate.com. Unlike the cases of Equifax and Sony Pictures, the hackers did not target a single network, but a network monitoring system, Orion, used by as many as 18,000 of SolarWinds clients. Orion's malware-infected updates gave the hackers access to everything on these networks, and it will take years to ferret out every backdoor the intruders might have embedded. How America should respond is a tricky question, said Erica Borgard and Jacqueline Schneider in Wired.com. This wasn't a cyber attack. No one was hurt, and neither the networks nor the data they house were degraded. More accurately, this was a significant espionage achievement, a category of action that is an accepted part of international statecraft that the U.S. has historically responded to with sanctions, arrest, diplomacy, or counterintelligence, not treated as an act of war. However you characterize it, the potential this assault creates for further mischief is breathtaking, said Hal Brands in Bloomberg.com. Using embedded backdoors, spies could gum up the works of federal agencies, delete sensitive or classified information, or even launder disinformation through seemingly reputable sources. That's why the hack deserves a response beyond what we turn to for run-of-the-mill espionage. It's time for the U.S. to show some of its hidden cyber weapons in order to ensure that Russian President Vladimir Putin knows there will be a high cost to future attacks or to weaponizing what he's already stolen. I'm going to read you the editor's letter this week. In this space a year ago, I admitted to a pessimistic feeling about 2020. If President Trump loses an election that will be the ugliest of our lifetimes, I said, he will denounce the results as a fraudulent coup and refuse to accept them. This forecast required no prescience. Donald Trump has cried fraud after every election whose results he didn't like, including the 2016 Iowa primary that he insisted should be nullified because Ted Cruz had stolen it. But while an election fiasco was utterly predictable, my crystal ball failed to foresee the defining catastrophe of the coming year. At this time last December, a virus was silently jumping from person to person in Wuhan, China, and would soon radically transform every one of our lives. Never make predictions, the great sage Casey Stengel reminded us, especially about the future. Still, there is reason for cautious optimism for 2021. Democracy has survived, although with open wounds which will not quickly heal. Vaccination has begun after less than a year of development and testing, a nearly miraculous achievement. Life may return to a semblance of normal by summer. How incredibly sweet it will be to gather again with family, friends, and coworkers. Even now, with that rebirth too far away and our terrible losses still mounting, we can find a space for gratitude. The list of people who've earned it is long. The brilliant scientists who made the vaccines possible, the doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers who defied their exhaustion, fear, and heartbreak to save lives and to comfort the dying. The post office workers, delivery people, teachers, meat packers, farm workers, cops, EMTs, supermarket cashiers, cooks, and other frontline workers who've risked their lives to keep us fed and supplied the country functioning. It's been a truly horrible year, with one painful blow after another. But we're still standing, so let's give ourselves a round of applause. That was from the editor-in-chief, William Falk. And we'll go right into the controversy of the week. Trump, now in the final act of King Lear. So here we finally are, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com, at the foreign bunker stage of the Trump presidency. The New York Times and Axios.com are reporting that President Trump is alarming even his closest aides as he unravels and rages in the final days of his presidency, bitterly denouncing erstwhile allies like Mitch McConnell and Bill Barr, while listening to the toadies who continue to indulge his delusions that he can still overturn the election. At a four-hour Oval Office meeting last week, Trump huddled with unhinged loyalist Rudy Giuliani, lawyer Sidney Powell, and former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and seriously discussed Flynn's plan for Trump to declare martial law in key swing states and had the military rerun the election. This proposal for a full-blown coup triggered a loud argument with saner aides like White House counsel Pat Cipollone. But Trump continued to talk about appointing the widely mocked conspiracy theorist Powell as a special counsel to investigate voter fraud. These insane ideas may not be implemented, said Max Boot in the Washington Post, but the fact that a defeated president used the Oval Office to discuss staging a military coup marks a new low. Even after everything he's put us through, Trump saved the worst for last. There's no need for alarmism, said David Greenberg in the Washington Post. Thanks to the resilience of our democratic institutions, the courts, state election officials, the Electoral College, Trump has no moves left to play. His discussion of martial law was a temper tantrum, not a serious attempt at a coup. There are some things a president shouldn't even discuss, said Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com. And having the military intervene in a U.S. election is high on that list. But Trump often says outrageous things, and he's shown repeatedly that his talk is just talk. It's not surprising that Trump would disgrace himself after an election loss, said Rich Lowry and Ramesh Panuru in NationalReview.com. His refusal to accept bad news has been a defining feature of his administration. What is more alarming is how many elected Republicans have held their tongues even when the president began to actively and explicitly seek to overturn an election result not to his liking. By enabling Trump's attack on democracy itself, they've set a terrible precedent for future elections, especially close ones. Trump's King Lear-like descent into madness was predictable, said Peter Winter in TheAtlantic.com. But the fact that 18 Republican attorneys general and 126 House members signed on to a doomed lawsuit to overturn the election demonstrates that Trump has turned his party into an instrument of illiberalism and nihilism. Trump's cult-like base truly believes the lie of the stolen election, said Rosie Gray in BuzzFeedNews.com. These tens of millions of Americans live in a parallel universe of separate facts and conspiracy theories, with a separate media ecosystem that feeds their paranoia and anger. Talk to people at any Trump rally, some of them armed, and you'll hear earnest predictions of violence, secession, and civil war. First, though, we have to worry about the next 3 weeks, said Jack Holmes in Esquire.com. A degenerate narcissist still commands our military and the awesome powers of the presidency until January 20th. And he has made it clear that he will seek maximum vengeance before he's forced to leave. What deranged and dangerous stunt will Trump pull next? And our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for catharsis, with the news that Atlantic City, New Jersey is auctioning off the chance to push the detonator button that implodes the bankrupted shell of the Trump Plaza Hotel and Casino, with proceeds benefiting local youth charities. It was a good week for revelation after televangelist Pat Robertson, who claimed in October that God had assured him President Trump would win re-election, called the president very erratic and urged him to concede and not run in 2024. You've had your day, and it's time to move on, said Robertson, aged 90. It was a good week for corrections. after a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee was quietly removed from the U.S. Capitol and replaced with a statue of civil rights icon Barbara Johns. As a 16-year-old in 1951, Johns led a protest against poor conditions in her all-black Virginia high school and helped trigger the landmark Brown versus Board ruling. But it was a bad week for the nose. After the supervisor of a Rainesville, Alabama sewage treatment plant was suspended for allegedly making and bottling wine on the premises. "We try," shrugged Rainesville Mayor Roger Lingerfelt, "but you can't stop every little thing that goes on." It's a bad week for resting in peace. After an Argentine court ruled that the body of deceased soccer legend Diego Maradona cannot be cremated until his DNA is no longer needed to settle 6 paternity suits. And finally, it was a bad week for autocorrect. After Wisconsin police swarmed a woman's apartment when her father reported that she was being stabbed, the puzzled woman showed up minutes later, returning from a coronavirus testing center where she had tried to text her father that she was being swabbed. We're going to read a few of the short pieces from the U.S. at a glance and the world at a glance this week. Starting with the U.S. at a glance from Washington, D.C., President Trump pardoned 20 people this week, including 2 people convicted as part of the Mueller probe and 4 former Blackwater Worldwide military contractors who killed 14 unarmed Iraqi civilians, including 2 children, during the 2007 shooting spree in Baghdad's Nusayr Square. George Papadopoulos, 33, and Alex Vandersvan, 36, both were pardoned after misleading investigators working for Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Trump also pardoned 3 former congressmen convicted of corruption. Chris Collins was convicted of insider trading and lying to the FBI. Steve Stockman stole donations intended for charity. And Duncan Hunter pleaded guilty to misusing campaign funds. Hunter and Collins were early and active supporters of Trump's 2016 run. "If you lie to cover up for the president, you get a pardon," said Representative Adam Schiff. "If you are a corrupt politician who endorsed Trump, you get a pardon. If you murder civilians while at war, you get a pardon." Palm Beach, Florida. Turning Point USA, a conservative student group, brought hundreds of maskless revelers to Florida, creating a series of potential super spreader events. As coronavirus deaths mounted in the state, the group's 4-day student action summit kicked off with a maskless gala at President Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort, where attendees posed for selfies with former Trump advisor Roger Stone and White House press secretary Kayleigh McEnany. The next day, 2,000 people crowded into the Palm Beach County Convention Center to hear speeches by Donald Trump Jr. and Tucker Carlson. Sports drink maker Bang Energy, whose CEO has been a vocal Trump supporter, had young women blast bills into the crowd from a money cannon. Another tightly packed scene greeted Vice President Mike Pence when he addressed the gathering later. "Keep fighting until every last legal vote is counted," Pence said as the crowd chanted, "4 more years." West Point, New York. The U.S. Military Academy at West Point revealed this week that it has accused 73 students of violating the elite officer training program's vaunted honor code by cheating on a math exam. All but one of the students are first-year cadets. 4 resigned, 59 admitted guilt, and 8 others have denied involvement and now face hearings. The cheating came to light when instructors noted all the students had made the same error on a calculus exam given in May, after instruction went viral. Tim Bakken, law professor at the academy, called the scandal a national security issue, noting that cadets take a pledge not to lie, cheat, steal, or tolerate those who do. As a nation, we rely on the military to tell us honestly when we should fight wars and when we can win them, he said. Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy said the students will be held accountable. Georgia. State residents flocked to the polls for early voting in the state's twin Senate runoff elections this week, with the total number of ballots cast surpassing 1.6 million, just 3,000 fewer votes than at the same point in the presidential election. Democratic challengers John Ossoff and the Reverend Raphael Warnock both held razor-thin polling edges of less than a single percentage point over Republican incumbents David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler. They must both win for Democrats to control the Senate. Data from the nonpartisan group Georgia Votes shows black turnout running at 32% of all votes cast, an encouraging sign for Democrats. Perdue and Loeffler are urging GOP voters to turn up, despite claiming without evidence that the November election was marred by massive fraud. Neither has acknowledged Trump's defeat in the presidential race. "I'm still fighting alongside him," Perdue told Republican rallygoers. Here from the World at a Glance, Praia Cape Verde. A U.S. Navy ship has been on a secret mission off the western coast of Africa for the past month, part of a Trump administration effort to hobble Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, the New York Times reports. The mission was hatched in June when Alex Saab, a Colombian businessman believed to be Maduro's financial fixer, was arrested on U.S. money laundering charges during a refueling stop in the tiny island nation of Cape Verde en route from Iran to Venezuela. Fearing that Iran, which has sent fuel and weapons to Venezuela, might try to spring Saab before he could be extradited, administration officials demanded that then-Defense Secretary Mike Esper deploy a Navy ship to Cape Verde. Esper refused, saying it would be a misuse of American military power. When Esper was fired in November and replaced by Christopher Miller, the Pentagon deployed the ship. Coronavirus on every continent. General Bernardo O'Higgins Base, Antarctica. The coronavirus reached the seventh continent this week, with Chile announcing that 36 people at a research station on the Antarctic Peninsula had tested positive. The infected 26 members of the Chilean military and 10 maintenance workers were evacuated from the base to the Chilean city of Punta Arenas, along with some 30 other people. Three COVID cases have also been confirmed on a Chilean Navy ship returning from Antarctica. The Council of Managers of National Antarctic Programs has warned that the virus could have catastrophic consequences on the continent because of the cold, dry air and the limited medical resources at the 40 research bases operated by various countries. Food emergency, Dover, UK. German airline Lufthansa airlifted 80 tons of fresh food to England this week so that British groceries would have produce on hand for Christmas. France had closed its crossings with the UK for 2 days after a new strain of COVID was detected in Britain, causing miles-long backups of trucks at ports. Thousands of tractor-trailers were stuck in Dover for days waiting for ferries, and drivers said they had no access to toilets or food. Truckers groups warned that if the vehicles couldn't get to France, there would be a shortage of transport to pick up the fresh produce from the continent that's needed to refill the shelves. Poison sting. Moscow. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has duped one of the Kremlin agents believed to have poisoned him into confessing details of the assassination attempt. Investigative journalists last week revealed the names of 8 agents who had been tailing Navalny at the time he was poisoned in Siberia in August. Posing as a higher-up in the FSB intelligence agency and using a fake phone number that appeared to come from FSB headquarters, Navalny phoned one operative, Konstantin Kudryavtsev, and demanded to know why the attempted hit failed. In audio of the call released by Navalny, Kudryavtsev explains that the team put the toxic nerve agent Novichok in Navalny's underwear and even added a little extra to make sure it would kill the activists. Navalny made the call from Germany, where he is recovering. And finally, vaccines for all, Wellington, New Zealand. New Zealand says it will provide free COVID vaccinations to all of its 5 million people and to everyone in the tiny neighboring nations of Cook Islands, Niue, Samoa, Tonga, and Tuvalu. New Zealand has ordered shots from Pfizer and Johnson, and last week signed deals with AstraZeneca and Novavax. The country's potential supply is now nearly triple its population. This will be a sustained rollout over months, not weeks, said Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. But our pre-purchase agreements mean New Zealand is well positioned to get on with it as soon as it is proven safe to do so. New Zealand has eliminated the virus from its territory twice, first in May and then again after travelers from abroad brought the disease back in August. The country has reported only 2,128 cases and 25 deaths. We're on the briefing page, titled this week, The Christmas of 1918. A century ago, America celebrated the holidays under the shadow of a deadly pandemic. What was the mood then? In many ways, Americans were worse off than we are now. The nation had just endured the second and by far the deadliest wave of the Spanish flu pandemic, caused by the H1N1 virus originating in birds. The initial wave had started the previous March, spreading from an army base in Kansas, but was relatively mild with a low death rate. When the virus reared its head again in September, though, it had mutated into a far deadlier strain, one that killed victims within days or even hours of the onset of symptoms. Their lungs filled with so much fluid, blood, and mucus that victims essentially drowned, and their skin often turned blue. This strain hit the young and healthy particularly hard. In October 1918 alone, an estimated 195,000 Americans died, a staggering death toll given that the U.S. population was less than a third of what it is now. But the wave swept through fairly quickly, and by December there was a sense that the threat had largely passed. The holiday spirit is abroad in the land, wrote the Salt Lake Tribune, and the flu is not so much of a menace as it was a few weeks ago. There was another cause for celebration, the end of World War I. When did the war end? An armistice was agreed to on November 11th. Ending a brutal conflict in which some 116,000 U.S. servicemen died, though more succumbed to the flu than to actual combat. So the nation was feeling celebratory in spite of the flu's carnage. The mood was absolutely euphoric for most of the country, said historian Kenneth Davis, author of a book on the pandemic, More Deadly Than War. In his Thanksgiving proclamation, President Woodrow Wilson spoke of the nation's special and moving cause to be grateful and to rejoice. In New York City, where thousands of returning servicemen were arriving by ship, Yuletide will be a time of rejoicing over victory, wrote the New York Times on Christmas Eve. The city was rolling out the red carpet with vaudeville shows, dances, sightseeing buses, and Christmas tree parties, the paper wrote, saying, there should be no unfed or unentertained man or woman in this city. So Christmas went on as usual. Then, as now, the need to celebrate was balanced with a healthy fear of contagion. Stores were mostly open, but the Council of National Defense decreed that shopping should be done early and limited to useful gifts. And health officials ordered department stores to curb crowd-gathering displays featuring Santa Claus. "Santa Claus is down with the flu," read a December 6 headline in the St. Paul Daily News. While many restrictions put in place at the height of the fall wave had been relaxed, church services were still barred in many locales, and major Christmas events were canceled, from Milwaukee's tree lighting ceremony to Denver's Salvation Army Christmas parties to holiday school assemblies in Fall River, Massachusetts. A Columbus Evening Dispatch story detailed how the influenza ban had dealt a severe blow to Christmas plans, quashing many delightful entertainments. Caroline Schumacher of Carroll, Iowa, wrote in a letter that it is terrible when there's no church. It didn't seem like Christmas at all. Did families gather? That was less a point of contention than it is now, perhaps in large part because extended families generally live together or in close proximity, and few traveled far to share a Christmas roast. But that doesn't mean concern was absent. "Beware the mistletoe," read a warning from the Ohio Health Commissioner. "You will show your love for dad and mother, brother, sister, and the rest of them best this year by sticking to your own home instead of paying annual Christmas visits, holding family reunions, and parties generally." In a manner that feels distinctly familiar in 2020, the police chief in Fresno, California, hedged his cautionary words by making clear he had no desire to interfere with anyone's freedom or fun. Still, he felt compelled to point out that not assembling indoors would do much toward checking the further spread of this epidemic that is causing so much sickness and death. What happened afterward? Lots of new infections. With the pandemic's third wave beginning in January, it wasn't nearly as virulent as the second one, but nonetheless, it killed tens of thousands more Americans. In Seattle, where a November Seattle Times headline had trumpeted epidemic virtually over, half of the roughly 5,000 city residents who died of the flu were stricken after Christmas. "I helped lay away more people this winter than I ever did in all my life," John Tinty of Iowa wrote of burying friends and neighbors. "It sure was awful." By the time it petered out in summer 1919, the Spanish flu had killed an estimated 675,000 Americans and more than 50 million people worldwide. A debate over masks. As Christmas 1918 approached in San Francisco amid a continuing flu pandemic, the city was caught up in a fervid debate. Should citizens be made to wear masks? 2 months earlier, it had been the first U.S. city to pass a mask law, backed up with a fine of $5 or up to 10 days in prison. But resistance was wide and strong. Opponents called the masks uncomfortable, unsightly, and an impingement on their freedom, and hundreds of resistors were arrested, requiring extra police shifts. When the law expired on November 21st, people celebrated and threw their masks into the street. As case numbers rose and Christmas loomed, the city reconsidered a ban, but amid fierce opposition, it was voted down on December 19th. Weeks later, a surge would bring a reinstatement of the ban, giving rise to an anti-mask league. But for Christmas at least, residents were free to go barefaced, to the chagrin of Public Health Director William Hassler. "The dollar sign," he lamented, "is exalted above the health sign." Read a couple of the best U.S. columns, starting with Buttigieg's potential impact. If Pete Buttigieg is Pete Buttigieg the best qualified candidate for transportation secretary? Asked Henry Grabar. Emphatically not. Given his scant transportation experience, Mayor Pete's nomination was an obvious reward for endorsing Joe Biden during the Democratic primaries. But that doesn't mean he's a bad choice. The relentless ambition that bothers Buttigieg's detractors well positions him to make an impact in a field that is a total disaster. Americans are over-reliant on cars, air travel is teetering on the brink of collapse, and public transit is decades behind on global best practices. The transportation secretary will be at the center of any plan to reduce the country's carbon footprint and must help repair the damage the pandemic did to both airlines and transit agencies. As South Bend mayor, Buttigieg had a strong record on urban design issues, pushing successfully for more affordable housing, pedestrian-safe streets, and a better rail connection to Chicago. As a presidential candidate, he spoke persuasively of the damage caused by our car culture. With his eye on higher office, the wonky, highly articulate Rhodes Scholar will push hard for signature accomplishments in an area with a lot to fix. Buttigieg could really make an impact. Why DeSantis covers up COVID data. Even by Florida standards, Governor Ron DeSantis is a COVID catastrophe, said Lizette Alvarez. The Republican governor has embraced a reckless, stay-open-at-all-cost strategy that has needlessly damaged the lives of so many Floridians. He scoffed at masks, sided with herd immunity advocates, allowed bars and restaurants to remain open, and barred local governments from fining mask scoff laws or implementing new restrictions in response to the state's soaring infection rates. To hide the consequences of his policies, DeSantis has aggressively sought to suppress information about hospitalizations, new cases, and deaths, even ordering the state health department not to mention COVID-19 in the weeks before the presidential election. The result has been a disaster. Florida has suffered 1.2 million COVID cases, third in the nation behind California and Texas, 61,000 hospitalizations, and 20,000 deaths. And the current test positivity rate is an alarming 10%. DeSantis insists his policies save jobs because many businesses remain open, but his scorn for mask wearing, social distancing, and other precautions is reprehensible. No wonder many Floridians are now wearing "my governor is an idiot" face masks and referring to him as Death Santis. This is a short viewpoint piece in with the columns from Tom Nichols in theatlantic.com, who says, "If we've learned one thing about Trumpism, it is that no motivating ideology stands behind it, unless we think of general grievance and a hatred of cultural and intellectual elites as an idea. When views are incoherent and beliefs are rooted in fantasies, compromise is impossible. I am talking about the people who are giving Trump their full-throated support to the very end, even as he mulls a military coup. The people who buy weird paintings of Trump crossing the Delaware or who believe that Trump is an agent of Jesus Christ, these supporters have gone far beyond political loyalty and have succumbed to a kind of mass delusion." So next week we will read more of the year in review type articles, but for today we'll finish out on the talking points page as we often do. Here's an article, "Snow Days, Why They May Be Gone for Good." "A beloved ritual could be coming to an end," said Troy Clausen in the New York Times. As teachers and school districts have become accustomed to remote classes during the pandemic, it no longer makes sense to cancel school on the day of a big snowfall. Philadelphia's public schools held classes remotely during last week's blizzard. Denver, no stranger to snow, scrapped snow days in October. And officials in Omaha said that they intended to abolish the practice permanently. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio announced that public school kids in his sprawling system would have fully remote learning despite a snowstorm last week. I'm kind of sad for the kids, he said, adding that snow days were a thing of the past. Not entirely, but the trend is moving in that direction, said Mark Lieberman in edweek.org. We surveyed school officials across the country and discovered that 39% had already given up snow days for good, and another 32% were considering doing so. No one wants to be making up snow days until it's almost July, said the Pittsfield, Massachusetts Berkshire Eagle in an editorial. But it would be sad to take them away. Kids feel real joy when they wake up to a snowstorm, find out school is canceled, and spend the day frolicking in a winter wonderland. Let's keep that winter tradition alive. The idea of abolishing snow days is impractical, said Jessica Bayan in NJ.com. As any parent who has tried to get a child to focus on Google Classroom knows, it's a challenge on the best of days. Now imagine trying to do it when the snow is coming down. Let's be honest, said Andrew Boris in WPDH.com. As the parent of 9-year-old, I know kids are falling behind in their education despite teachers' best efforts at online instruction. Our kids don't need to lose another day of schooling because of nostalgia for snow days. Remote learning rarely encompasses a full day, and with no bus ride home, kids can just run right outside and have hours to play before dinner. Besides, if school is canceled, does anyone believe today's kids will spend the day on sleds and making snowmen, as opposed to getting on their electronic devices to play virtual games or swap photos and message with friends? Better that kids are learning something during that screen time. Trump, what did he accomplish? Few presidents have left office with so little accomplished as Donald Trump, said David Frum in theatlantic.com. The once strong economy he claimed credit for was inherited, and the Republican tax cut he signed ballooned the deficit to $1 trillion while failing to stimulate business investment or boost economic output. Yet nobody does nothing as president, and here are some accomplishments Americans, regardless of party, can reckon as successes of the Trump era. His administration's First Step program took cautious but humane steps toward prison reform. He launched Space Force, smartly consolidating space defense operations under a central command. He safeguarded our 5G networks from Chinese control by insisting on using Western technology, sped generic drug approval that will save consumers money, and brought long-delayed justice to Iranian terrorism mastermind General Qassem Soleimani. On the foreign policy front, said Kim Jalgard and Deirdre Shorkstrand in USA Today, Trump presided over historic normalization agreements between Israel and four Arab states. Under Trump's watch, the U.S. destroyed ISIS's caliphate in Iraq and Syria and killed leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Most foreign policy experts agree that Trump's instincts were right in getting tough on China for its trade practices. Then there's the stunning success of Operation Warp Speed, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. The $10 billion the administration pledged to develop 8 vaccine candidates led to the greatest public health achievement in history, the biological equivalent of the moon landing. Trump's crowning achievement was in eliminating an insidious enemy, said Alexandra Petri in the Washington Post. I am talking, of course, about low-flow showerheads. He was fixated on this scourge and finally succeeded in relaxing restrictions. Stronger shower flow will be his legacy. Trump also delivered on his central campaign promise, said Jason Han in the Philadelphia Inquirer. As a South Korean immigrant long enamored of America's democratic principles, I watched aghast as he attacked American institutions and moved the country down the road to tyranny. But the press and the courts held firm, and tens of millions of Americans rallied to defend democracy by voting in unprecedented numbers. Trump did make America great again, just not in the ways that he envisioned. Time for a few short notes. Some 81,000 Americans died of drug overdoses between June 2019 and May 2020, the highest 12-month total in history. Isolation, stress, and depression caused by the pandemic have hit those with substance use disorder hard, said CDC Director Robert Redfield. Since 1800, more than 700 measures to abolish or reform the Electoral College have been introduced in Congress, including one by Alexander Hamilton, one of the original architects of that system for electing presidents. Abolishing electors would require a constitutional amendment, and all attempts to pass one have failed. For the first time, the U.S. Air Force turned over control of a military flight to artificial intelligence. The algorithm used lessons it learned from 500,000 simulations to safely navigate and operate a U-2 Dragon Lady surveillance aircraft, although a human did act as co-pilot. And we'll finish out the show with a quote from comedian Victor Borg, quoted in Parade, who says, "Santa Claus has the right idea. Visit people only once a year." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And we thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.